On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into Jalen Brunson's dominant playoff run. We also look into how the Knicks contained Victor Wembanyama. And finally, where is Giannis Antetokounmpo going to end up? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Aberstrow, and we do this every Wednesday or Thursday, depending on the week. It's the finals. Game one is in the books, and my man, your man, Dan Devine, was there in San Antonio for that game one win by the New York Knicks. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. I'm caffeinated and devastated, as the great Walt Clyde Frazier might rhyme at this early hour after a late night file, but dude, it is a wild time for the New York Knicks. Another double-digit third quarter deficit, late comeback, another road win, 12 straight wins in the playoffs, 1-0 lead home court advantage in the NBA Finals for the Knicks. It's been a kind of magical six-week run, and it certainly appears to all start with number 11. So I'm wondering, Tom, does our big number this week have something to do with him?
Yeah, Jalen Brunson. We got to do a deep dive on that guy. This week's big number is plus 232. That is Jalen Brunson's plus minus this postseason, according to Stathead. That is the second highest for any player in the postseason in the play-by-play era. That's 1997 and on. So basically in the last 30 years, no player has done more winning than Jalen Brunson, except for that guy, Stephen Curry, back in 2017. So when we talk about a winning player, a guy that has caught a lot of flack over his size, second round pick, can he do it? He is doing it right now, and he's doing it in the final stage. And he was plus six in this game after struggling, being hobbled. He was going in and out of the gym, going back to the locker room, and he finished a plus six. Look at LeBron James, his best. Doesn't hold a candle to Jalen Brunson, Kevin Durant, Ben Wallace. We look at all of these greats on all-time great teams, and still none of those multi-MVPs, top 10 players of all time, have had a winning run like Jalen Brunson has had. So plus 232, which means, for those who don't know what plus minus measures, it's when that player is on the floor, what is the scoreboard for your team? And the Knicks have outscored opponents by 232 points with Jalen Brunson on the floor, not just in the past 12 games on their 12-0 streak. We're talking the entire postseason, and Stephen Curry with that loaded KD team was plus 244. So we might actually, Dan, be sitting here in a week's time talking about how Jalen Brunson had the winningest stretch we have seen by any individual player in 30 years. And probably beyond that, considering that the Knicks have one of the best, if not the best, point differential of a postseason run for any team in NBA history. And that guy, Jalen Brunson, has been on the floor for just about all of those big moments. And the big moments, man, we can count them off in game one. The way he led all scorers in the fourth quarter, 14 points. Dude, this guy, what is left to say about Jalen Brunson when it comes to winning time and the performance that he led after going to the locker room with the knee injury and then getting his foot stepped on, his ankle stepped on? You were there. Can you put into words what we're seeing with Jalen Brunson and the way he led this Knicks team to victory in game one?
I think that the thing to note about plus minus, right, is like you'll hear from people, from coaches, from executives, whatever, like, well, single game plus minus is, it can be noisy, right? Like you can have a teammate hit three threes and all of a sudden you're plus nine and you didn't really do anything, right? Over a larger sample, though, it does tell us a story. It does indicate to us, well, when this person's on the floor, his team wins the game, or wins those minutes. And when what you're seeing with Jalen Brunson is, I think the sum total of what he brings, there is the shot making. There's the ability to create for himself or draw two to the ball. Mike Brown talks about it all the time, those sprays out to teammates where you've got OG Anunoby or Karl Towns or Mikal Bridges spaced in the corners or up in the slot. that he can create for others, the ability to get to the free throw line and generate points that way, the ability to avoid turnovers and ensure that the Knicks get a shot on goal and don't give up odd man rushes the other way. All of these things are sort of wrapped up in his ability to, you know, control the pace of the game, make sure that, you know, the Knicks are, you know, speeding up when they want to and slowing down when they want to, all those sorts of things. It's a control metric to some degree. And I think what you're seeing and what you saw last night, even when Jalen Brunson was misfiring and wasn't able to get his shot online, the Knicks didn't lose touch, right? The Knicks were still, I think the furthest they got down was 14 midway through the third quarter. And they didn't blink. They didn't stop believing, in part because we are one round removed from them being down 22 with way less time in the game and coming back because Jalen Brunson can get on fourth quarter heaters like nobody else in the league right now. And he didn't win Clutch Player of the Year this year. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander did, and that was richly deserved for the regular season that Shai had. But I think that if you asked around the league, fourth quarter of a playoff game right now, who do you want? I would imagine you're going to get an awful lot more answers for Jalen Brunson than just about anybody else in the league. And he showed that why last night. He had 17 points on 22 shots through three quarters. When he checked in, I think about like 7.5 minutes to go in the fourth, he had 8 points on three shots in a minute and a half. And all of a sudden the Knicks were up. And that's like, that's what he brings, that confidence, that sort of belief of, if we stay close, he's going to get us over the finish line. And there's a ton of guys that deserve a ton of credit for what happened on Monday night for that, or on a Wednesday night, rather. Sorry, the days are all blurring together. In game one, with that coming, Karl Anthony Towns, phenomenal job. Josh Hart shot out of a cannon all over the place in the second half. Huge shots from, you know, Deuce McBride, OG Anunoby. The list of heroes is long. It starts, though, as it always does, with Jalen Brunson. And that huge plus minus figure tells me is when they have him on the floor, they are a winning basketball team. And that's what all of this is built around.
It is crazy. You talk about control and the consistency and the stability that he represents on the floor as a leader, that he never gets too high, never gets down too low. And the consistency is borne out in the numbers. When you look at his plus minus, not just in the aggregate, plus 232, which is the big number, there's also another number here is 15, which is the number of games in a row that Jalen Brunson has had a positive plus minus for the Knicks. Not a single game this postseason has he been below in the red in those minutes onto the floor. That is the second longest streak in the play-by-play era, tied with Karl Anthony Towns, of course, one of his teammates. Steph Curry on that 2017 team with Draymond Green. Again, stacked with KD on that squad. And Manu Ginobili, with the Spurs of all teams, had 17 straight games in a postseason in which he was on the floor when the team won his minutes on the floor. And we're seeing Jalen Brunson as an opportunity here with three more wins. In resounding fashion, he could be on the top of this list too. I mean, think about what this means. Every single game when that dude is on the floor, the Knicks are winning. And it boggles the mind when you talk about how in the postseason, Dan, we always talk about how in the championship, if you want to win the big one, you can't have one-way guys. You can't have guys who aren't willing to play both ends of the floor. And conventionally, the reputation of Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns is you cannot have those two guys on the floor and expect to win at the highest levels. I'm sorry. We're done with that. The notion that Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns don't do enough defensively to be able to be a championship team, you're seeing it in the plus minus. You're seeing it in the way that Wemby was bottled up in game one for most of that game with Karl Anthony Towns guarding him. And Jalen Brunson was not exploited at all. They were not targeting Jalen Brunson in ways where you're like, man, they've got to figure out a way to not be able to exploit those mismatches. When he was the primary defender on Spurs guys, they weren't getting buckets on Jalen Brunson in game one. So credit to Mike Brown, credit to Karl Anthony Towns, all the role players on the Knicks. But the consistency in which Jalen Brunson is leading this Knicks team to victory, I think, is also a defensive story, that this Knicks team we thought of them as like, hey, they're just going to outscore everybody, and that's the way that they're going to win games. No, they're playing great defense, and still with those two guys on the floor that traditionally we have not regarded as elite defensive players.
You're absolutely right. And it's funny, you know, you bring up the names, you brought up the name Steph Curry as the person who had the one higher plus minus in a postseason run. And I'm reminded of the kind of the journey with Steph and those Warriors teams of, you don't have to be a lockdown stopper, but you need to be able to participate on the defensive end, right? And so they sort of developed with Steve Kerr and, you know, the Ron Adams and that staff, that kind of like high hedge coverage. We're going to have him come all the way out on the ball screen and kind of like tag, make the screener go back the other way, and then he can recover. And so we just want to slow that action down and not get you hunted. And then when you do get hunted, as you know, so how many finals in a row did we watch LeBron just play like search and destroy with Steph? Mm-hmm. He's got to be able to hold up as best he can. You know, foul if you need to, give resistance. Don't just let it be a blow by an Ole defense. We are seeing that from Jalen Brunson now. He's not a pigeon. He's not somebody that can just be bulldozed. He is, you know, a fire hydrant out there. He is not somebody that's going to be backed down without giving any resistance. And you combine that with, you're absolutely right to point to Karl Towns. Like, he's not a huge shot blocker, and he probably never will be, although he did have a nice block in game one, you know, coming over from the help side on a play where Brunson was being targeted. But his ability to anchor and, you know, physically move his feet with wings or bigs, did very often wrestling with Victor Wembanyama, a huge reason why Victor Wembanyama had a sluggish offensive performance in game one. And then to be able to sort of toggle among between fours and fives, to be able to play as the lone big or alongside Mitchell Robinson in a two big look, going back to what we saw from him in Minnesota alongside Rudy Gobert, his sort of development and evolution into a real two-way player, like a bona fide defensive five, who is also maybe the best defensive rebounder in the league right now or close to, all of that plays a role. What we had heard for years was, you can't have two defensive liabilities. Towns, the way he's played for most of this season, not even going back to like just the start of the playoffs, for most of this season, for my money, means that you were down to one. And then if Brunson is going to hold up at his end of the bargain, you suddenly have fewer places to be able to poke. And then Mike Brown, as you mentioned, can insulate with those wings, can have OG Anunoby and Mikhail Bridges in sort of help position, have Josh Hart as a chaos agent flying around off the ball to generate deflections and steals. And the numbers bear it out. So going back to mid-January, so now we are talking about a span of nearly 60 games, 57 games for the Knicks. They are the number one defense in the NBA, regular season and postseason combined. And that's like 108.5 points per 100 possessions over that 57-game sample, according to our friends at pbpstats.com, with regular season and postseason combined. This is not a trick of the sample slicing, right? This is about 5 months of play, regular season, postseason, all kinds of competition in there. And now against the team that, you know, just vanquished the defending champions, held them to one of their worst offensive performances of the season, 81.6 points per 100 in the half court for San Antonio in game one, a dreadful number. If you take away the transition opportunities, you get back, you force them to play against your set defense, the Knicks are now the kind of defense that can be that sort of meat grinder. And even with Towns at the back line and Brunson at the point of attack. So it feels like a team that has figured out the answers to the test. Whatever the questions are that an opponent can ask, the Knicks have an answer for how to play it. And it didn't look great for the first 2.5 quarters of game one, just like it didn't look great for the first 3.5 quarters of game one against Cleveland. And yet the Knicks do not feel like they are ever out of it, thanks in large part to their point guard.
Yeah, I think the Knicks have to figure this out. One stat that I'm keeping an eye on is when the Knicks shot against Wemby, they shot 4 of 30 in this game. Wait a minute. No, that's not right. Oh, it's when the Spurs shot against Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns, they shot 4 of 30. I'm going to repeat that, everybody. When guarded by Jalen Brunson or Karl-Anthony Towns, the San Antonio Spurs in game one, according to the NBA's player tracking cameras, the Spurs shot 4 of 30 against these two defenders that entering this year and historically were considered negative defenders that were not able to guard at the highest levels. And the Spurs, the only time they scored on Jalen Brunson was late in the first quarter. They shot 1 of 15
wow.
on shots guarded by Jalen Brunson in game one. So if you're the Spurs, you can't be happy about the way that they were able to attack in the defense, like attack the Knicks defense and exploit those guys, make a move. But you got to hand it to Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns. You talk about having the answers to the test. They have got a cheat code or something that they figured out how to erase any of those liabilities that we for so long heard about, that it's going to be tough to have those two guys on the floor and win at the highest levels. I've been skeptical, Dan, of the ability for Jalen Brunson to size up and guard multiple positions, hold his own, and then Karl-Anthony Towns not fouling, defending the rim, moving his feet, and staying with guys like Victor Wembanyama, who's averaging 25-plus from the big position. But that stat is astounding. 4 of 30 going against those two defenders for the New York Knicks. So that's something that Mitch Johnson is going to try to figure out, is how do we get winning matchups and capitalize on those matchups. But at this point in the series, you know, I think they're going to still be trying some new things. We're going to talk about things that the Knicks and the Spurs are going to be looking at heading into game two. But before we do that, Dan, it's so cool to hear from the greats about Jalen Brunson. You know, we talk about the plus minus 232 and how he's just a winning player. Ian O'Connor over at The Athletic got a chance to catch up with Walt Clyde Frazier after the game, as well as Isaiah Thomas, who famously short guy in NBA standards, won a couple titles being a small guy out there, knows a little bit about what it takes to do it against the Giants out there. And just some of the quotes here I just wanted to cite. You know, when you talk about Jalen Brunson, Walt Frazier said he's got the tenacity of Willis Reed and he's got my cool. Anytime you can have the tenacity of Willis Reed and be as cool as Walt Clyde Frazier, you're winning at life. And Jalen Brunson winning in the box score, off the court, all of it, the king of New York right now. And I think it's worth noting Isaiah Thomas, who had an interesting stint with the New York Knicks organization. So, like, we'll leave it at that. Jalen Brunson, he said, Jalen is absolutely good enough to win it all. As small players, we tend to get overlooked, even though we're always beating bigger players. In people's minds, there seems to be some height and weight requirement to win a championship. Jalen won an Illinois state title in high school. He won 2 national titles in college. And now he's in the NBA finals. He's just a winner. And anytime analytics, you feel like are just some foo-foo-y that are made up in some calculator somewhere. This is one of those moments where analytics tell the story of a winning player plus 232 in the postseason. Dan, before we go into the little numbers here, anything else just from boots on the ground, any notes that you want to say about Jalen Brunson before we dig a little bit deeper in this series?
Well, the fact that he was able to come back from that early knee injury and that early, the ankle knock, Karl-Anthony Towns talked about it, like seeing him walk back to the bench was a sense of relief, not because, oh, he's going to be able to, save us in the game, but like they were worried about him. And I think that's the thing that, it can be a little bit trite, it can be a little cliched, but having been with the Knicks now for the last several weeks, to a man, they are talking about this like, it's beyond just we're coworkers, right? We're pulling in the same direction. That there's a real camaraderie and a spirit that they've gotten as a collectivism. I think bringing back virtually the entire core that hurt after that loss to Indiana in the conference finals last year, that felt how bad that was, and made that kind of commitment to one another, like, we are not going to feel that way again. They are playing like a team that never wants to feel that way again. And it calls to mind, it's not one-to-one, because of also obviously the nature of the heart rip, but that Spurs team that watched Ray Allen rip their hearts out in Miami and then lost that series and then came back the next year like an absolute war machine, playing some of the most beautiful basketball we've seen
it's
in decades.
Yep.
It's that's what this feels like right now, especially because as those guys walk off the floor, Mikal Bridges walks off the floor last night and they're like, how does it feel? He's like, 0-0. We are instantly resetting the score. We have to come out. Karl Anthony Towns asked, what comes next? Desperation. We have to play like the next, like this game didn't happen and the next one is a win or go home game. That mindset that like Mike Brown has inculcated in them, it's traveled. It is across this roster. And I think attitude reflects leadership. And Jalen Brunson with that, like never too high, never too low, even keeled, sort of quiet killer tenacity. You brought up Stephen Curry. Mike Brown said the leaders he's been around that remind him of Jalen Brunson are Steph Curry and Tim Duncan. Pretty good company to be in if you want to be in position to go win an NBA championship.
Yeah, just no emotion, all business, all about the work, and just a student of the game, grinding, all of those things where Steph Curry and Tim Duncan just had this energy about them and exuded confidence and something that everybody could get behind. And it seems like the whole entire city, the five boroughs, are getting behind Jalen Brunson, and he's leading them. I mean, the story of game one is against adversity, Jalen Brunson put the team on his back, and Karl Anthony Towns, certainly the defense against Wemby, Alvarado, Deuce McBride, Landry Shamet minutes, huge whenever Jalen Brunson left the game. The fact that they were able to stem the tide and be able to keep the game within reach and then let Jalen take over, just a collective amazing victory on the road in game one. So one guy we haven't really talked about very much is Victor Wembanyama. We're gonna go a little bit deeper into this series here with your three little numbers, Dan, right after the break. All right, Dan, big number, +232 from Jalen Brunson. It's like hard even to fathom how good he's been in this postseason run. Well, plus minus does a pretty good job of it. Well, we got three other numbers we want to talk about here with this series. So, Dan, what's your first little number?
First little number is a digit we just mentioned twice. It is 2. First little number this week is 2, which is how many field goal attempts Victor Wembanyama got after a paint touch in game one, according to the Second Spectrum tracking data. Just 2 shot attempts after a paint touch. He'd entered the finals averaging 4.5 shots off paint touches in these playoffs. And that it doesn't sound like a giant difference, two and a half fewer. It's representative of, I think, a broader strategic tactical move that the Knicks made in trying to limit him. Wemby did get some paint touches. He was there he and Towns, the two highest in the game. However, when he got there, the Knicks were either trying to swarm him to get him to get off the ball or just fouling him. Like they got underneath his rolls, they got underneath his transition rim runs, and they said, before he can gather and get the ball up, we are going to put him on the line. And you wound up with a concerted effort to really take away those easy paths, the entryways to the basket, where obviously we know he gets within, a step inside the free throw line. He's within arm's reach of dunking. He wound up with 21 field goal attempts in this game. He got one dunk late in the third quarter and 2 layups. Those were the only like arm's reach baskets he got. Everything else was a jumper or free throws. 16 of his 21 shot attempts came outside the restricted area. He only went 3 for 16 on those shot attempts. And, you talked earlier about Karl Anthony Towns deserves a ton of credit for the work that he did defensively in being physical with Wembanyama out on the perimeter, with tracking him on his drives, bumping him, but doing it without fouling a lot. Mitchell Robinson, when he came into the game, also Mitchell Robinson, able to play after breaking a bone in his hand in still murky circumstances that I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about after this series ends.
We might get a puncher's chance to stay, hearing about that, by the way. We might get a puncher's
chance. You just might.
You might.
The Knicks really didn't have to go to the much-discussed OG Anunoby matchup there until in the last couple of possessions of the game, because Towns was up to the challenge and Wembanyama wasn't able to make the Knicks pay for it. So you know, Mitch Johnson talked about it after the game. We've got to get him going more downhill. Wembanyama's response was basically like, I was bad. It's not really that deep. I got to figure out how to be better. What did you make of Wemby's shot diet in game one and sort of where San Antonio can try to get him a little bit cleaner to the rim moving forward in this series?
Yeah, this is one of the lowest performances I've seen from Wemby this postseason. When we did the roundtable, Dan, before the series started, the thing I was watching going into game one was Wemby's energy levels and whether he was going to burn himself out in the emotion and getting wrapped up in the emotion of game one. And you heard Karl-Anthony Towns after the game talk about how he had reached some sort of like zen out there, like getting into the arena. He felt the presence of his late mother watching over him, and he had this like serenity about him, and that he was just a kid again. I don't get the same vibe from Victor Wembanyama in that game. I think he was tired, and Karl-Anthony Towns was as cool as the other side of the pillow. When you talk about the rim attacks and the ability to play under pressure, Karl-Anthony Towns had 11 shots at the rim in game one, and Wemby had just 5. Jalen Brunson had 7 shots at the rim. Victor Wembanyama had just 5. So those two guys, again, we keep coming back to the stars of the Knicks and how they outshine the Spurs stars, in particular Wemby. Wemby played like a guard. And in his best moments, I do feel like Wemby is just relentless, trying to get to the cup, rolling hard, calling for those lobs, and making sure he gets those second chance opportunities and camping out in the paint on both ends of the floor. In game two, fact of the matter is Wemby has to play like the 7-18 guy that he is. And I thought too much. Mitch Johnson relied on those ISO ball, just try to dribble out and try to create a shot and play hero ball down the stretch instead of getting him good opportunities at the rim. I also think that Dylan Harper deserves more minutes. I thought that was a questionable move from Mitch Johnson to not go to him down the stretch, a guy who has been bullying so many guys, which is so mind-boggling, just totally reversing the script about how a rookie guard should be playing. He tossed OG Anunoby on a drive like 10 feet. And I was like, what? No one does that to OG. And he's able to get to the cup in ways. He was 4-of-4 in the restricted area in game one. And the stat here from ESPN Insights that Dylan Harper just passed the Admiral David Robinson for most points by a Spurs rookie ever. There have been some pretty good Spurs rookies. I don't know if anyone's been tracking that. But the Knicks were the team that played with more force, got to the cup, and you would not have thought that Jalen Brunson was 6'2", based on the fact of his shot chart. I compared the two this morning. One guy was living in the paint, and yes, he had some incredible backbreaking, amazing footwork jumpers in that game down the stretch. But Jalen looked like he was on a mission to get to the cup, and I would say the opposite for Victor Wembanyama, and I expect things to change big time in game two.
Yeah, Wembanyama, the money quote here was, obviously, we've been down in a series before, never in the finals, obviously, but I'm not kicking myself about anything, really. I'm not worried in the slightest. So glad he's not worried, and we'll see if there's something to worry about come game two with the way the Knicks are defending him. Second little number this week is 23. Another two digits that we mentioned earlier. That's how many second chance points the Knicks generated in game one. And what's interesting here is it was a 23-14 edge in second chance points for the Knicks in a game that was like two possession game late into the fourth quarter. That 9-point margin is kind of the whole deal, right? But what's interesting is the Knicks got those 23 points off 10 offensive rebounds. So 2.3 points per offensive rebound. There were 4 tip-ins or putbacks. One of them was an end one that Towns got during that series, that sort of sequence in the third quarter where he was just mauling the offensive glass. And 2 of them were dagger threes, what you talked about, where the Blazers will track them, an offensive rebound that leads right to a kick out to a three, including the sort of backbreaker late in the game where Jalen Brunson tips and OG Anunoby miss away from Devin Vassell. Mikal Bridges gets it. Brunson relocates to the corner, hits him corner three. It makes it 97-95 with 1:50 to go, which is really like, and that put the Knicks up kind of for good. And the interesting thing, again, another interesting thing, here I am being very interesting, the Spurs finished with more offensive rebounds. They were plus four in offensive rebounds than the Knicks. They won the overall possession battle, which I need to track with a tool that Jared Dubin has at his site, Last Night in Basketball, kind of measures the differentials between teams' offensive rebounds, turnovers, free throw attempts. The Spurs had a little over two more possessions than the Knicks in this game. But the Spurs, 14 offensive rebounds, 14 points. The Knicks 10 into 23. And that was really the gap. So, I mean, we knew going back to the NBA Cup final, Mitchell Robinson sort of Godzilla-ing all over the place. Pretty quiet night on the offensive glass for Mitch last night, but the Knicks still able to make a massive impact in those second chance opportunities. What did you make of how they were able to get some of those? And is that something that the Spurs can kind of turn off or adjust to in game two?
Well, a lot of those were just Josh Hart getting to the cup, or Mitchell Robinson, like the force that they played with, like, again, the restricted area was won by the Knicks, and those dagger threes, they had two dagger threes. I mean, huge three pointers off of those second chance opportunities, but that's all they took. So, like, if you're the Knicks, you're like, we actually probably could have, you know, made more hay if they got to a lot of those dagger threes more. And they take them, Charlotte and Portland take the most dagger threes in the NBA. They love to get those second chance from downtown opportunities. And so they actually didn't do a whole lot of that in this one. So it's almost like they have some room for improvement in here and have those backbreaking threes that were so consequential in this matchup against the Spurs. And something against a young team like this, like San Antonio, it can feel that much heavier when you're at home and you're giving up those threes and giving up those second chance opportunities. It's, you know, I think a big part of this is Wemby guarding Karl-Anthony Towns, dragging him away from the paint, and he isn't able to just roam and play free safety in the paint like he did against OKC. I think that's a big reason why you're seeing so many of those second chance opportunities being so fruitful for the Knicks, that when they were able to get those offensive rebounds and clean the glass, they were able to capitalize because Wemby was not just standing there walling off the rim. So I think that's great job by Mike Brown to utilize that. And we can't say enough good things about Josh Hart as a teammate, as a role player. I know, if you've played pickup before, you know that guy that just is relentless Energizer Bunny out there. And the jokes online about him saving the ball from out of bounds. There's not a lot of guys who are willing to put their body on the line like Josh Hart. And his stat line, incredible from game one. Was it 4 steals, 6 assists, 15 rebounds, and 3 points? Yeah. I mean, plus 22 in 27 minutes. Just getting those second chance opportunities and doing all the little things to play winning basketball. That's Josh Hart in a nutshell.
Yeah, there's a video that someone shared with me this morning. I don't remember. I'm not sure from which game it was. I don't know if it was from last night or from an earlier game, but where it's Josh Hart mic'd up and he's talking to Mitchell Robinson. And he goes up and says, "You get regular rebounds. I get rebounds that break teams." And I think that sounds about right. You know, hard to argue with Josh on that point. And to your point about Mike Brown, he was asked about the offensive rebounding kind of strategy after the game when you've got Wemby lifted out of the paint, whether he's guarding Cat or often if he's guarding Hart, but in that kind of ghost coverage where he's sagging off him, but he's not directly under the rim. And he said, like, you know, if that's where Wemby's at, if he's out of the paint, we want Cat in the dunker. We want to take advantage. Like, if he vacates that space, we want to slide into it and we want to dominate that space. Towns has been, you know, I think 4 of his 12 offensive of his rebounds last night were offensive, you know, a huge component in that. Our third and final little number this week, and you mentioned the Dylan Harper of it all, so we'll kind of come back around to that. Third and final little number is -7. That is how many net points De'Aaron Fox contributed to the Spurs game one efforts, according to the godfather of analytics, Dean Oliver's metrics over at ESPN. His net points metric aims to show how many points above or below average a player creates for his team in a given game. And on a night where De'Aaron Fox went 3-for-9 inside the three-point arc, or 3-for-10, I believe, 0-for-3 beyond it, 7 points in 38 minutes, a scoreless fourth quarter with 3 fouls and 2 turnovers, Fox finished at -7 net points, which was the lowest figure on the Spurs. The highest figure on the Spurs was +3.3, which belonged to Dylan Harper. who spent the last 4 minutes of game one on the bench watching as the Spurs kind of kicked it away late. In fairness, after a really strong start, you mentioned the 4-for-4 inside the restricted area, the, you know, the bully ball drives. Harper had a really rocky third quarter. It was minus 13 in the third quarter as the Knicks kind of went on that big run late to get the game from 14 down to tied heading into the fourth. And Fox has had some big minutes in these playoffs. 21 points and 9 assists in both closeout games against Portland and Minnesota. Fights through the high ankle sprain to come back against OKC and kind of help curb the turnover issues they've had. But De'Aaron Fox is shooting 42% from the field in the playoffs. He's shooting 30% from three in the playoffs. And he just got summarily outclassed by Jalen Brunson in game one. So kind of at the risk of being pretty basic here with the analysis, it feels like if De'Aaron Fox is going to play 38 minutes a game, going to need a hell of a lot more from him to right the ship, no?
I think Dylan Harper should have more minutes in game two than De'Aaron Fox. I think De'Aaron Fox is skating from a lot of criticism right now because of the high ankle sprain, sure, but we don't make these exceptions for other star players, all-star players, two-time all-star De'Aaron Fox, clutch player of the year De'Aaron Fox, guy who's making the highest salary on the Spurs team. We can't overlook the fact that since he returned from injury in that OKC series, he's shooting 19% from downtown. That's 5 of 26 on threes. And then on twos, he's shooting 42%, 21 of 50. So coming back from that injury, 34% from the floor, averaging 10.5 points per game. He's had single-digit scoring in three out of his last four games. And I also think he's kind of essential to keep Stephon Castle from turning it over double-digit times in a game, in the game. So it's a real predicament for Mitch Johnson. Is De'Aaron Fox does stabilize the offense a little bit when he's out there just keeping turnovers to a minimum. However, it's just brutal. I have no confidence when he shoots. I don't. Like that jumper that he had, the open shot that he had down the stretch, I didn't have any confidence that he was going to hit that. And that's probably informed by the fact that he has been, like Draymond Green-esque, or like the open shots where you just don't feel like they're going in. De'Aaron Fox has been awful. And I do think that the ankle sprain is sapping a lot of his zip, but we can't just ignore that the Spurs' second best player now is not De'Aaron Fox. I think he's the fourth best player on the Spurs, and that's a big problem going into the NBA Finals game two. Is they got to get better shots from De'Aaron Fox where he's not able to get to the cup, he's not able to shoot with confidence on his jumpers. And in his last four games, 9 points, 5 points, 15 in game seven, and was big down the stretch in game seven. I don't want to just crap all over the guy, but this is an all-star, and all-stars don't do this without getting any sort of criticism. And so on the big stage, De'Aaron Fox has to be better if the Spurs want to win this series.
Yeah, it feels like that's the puzzle that Mitch Johnson kind of has to solve here, because he understands, you know, we talked at the beginning of this, like, why is Wemby only getting, you know, two shots off paint and the paint off paint touches, right? Why is, and you know, Dylan Harper is going great guns, driving baseline, muscling guys off. But then where do you find the balance between Steph Castle trying to get downhill and look for his, and Dylan Harper trying to get downhill and look for his, and Wemby not maybe getting enough touches or in the right spots? And that's where you need De'Aaron Fox on the floor, right? The idea that he's more of the orchestrator. Those guys, Stephon Castle and Dylan Harper, are like better at creating for themselves than they are creating for the big guy at this point. So you need somebody that's going to make sure you feed the big guy. But then if he's not able to make the shots, yeah, this is the push and pull. This is the challenge of, and then you if you want to have multiple of those guys on the floor at any given time, yeah, that's the nice part about having three of them. But then are you cutting into, you know, champagne minutes where he was, you know, red hot in the first half and then kind of the Knicks shut his water off in the second half? Or, you know, is that coming at the detriment of some of the other wing options that you've got there if you're getting multiple guards on the floor? It's a rotation puzzle that Mitch Johnson kind of needs to solve. It's one that he wouldn't need to if Fox was playing like an all-star. Yeah. And if he's not going to do that regularly in this series, then I think the challenge becomes a little bit more acute for Johnson. But also very possible that, you know, get a night off, come back in game for game two on Friday. Fox is capable of turning this around, of knocking down some of those shots that looked no-hopers as he was pulling up. But at this point, yeah, the evidence does seem to be trending toward those are, it's more surprising when those go in than expected. And that's a tough spot to be in when that's the guy you need to be your closer there.
It's a different situation, but I'm reminded of 2011 NBA Finals with Mike Bibby starting over Mario Chalmers, where they acquired, the Miami Heat acquired Mike Bibby at the mid-season. And because he's Mike Bibby and because he's such a great point guard historically and the name value, I remember Eric Spoelstra talking about how he's a great orchestrator, a guy that gets us into our sets. But right. He also had the worst plus minus of any postseason we've ever seen. And it was a little too late. I think it was the final game of that series where Eric Spoelstra finally decided, I'm going to start Mario Chalmers, and it was too late. And it was clear that Mike Bibby just didn't have it. But because he's the veteran guy who they believed was going to be able to be that stabilizing presence at point guard to get him into sets. But ultimately, I'm not saying he cost them the series. LeBron James certainly was not up to his levels. But it reminds me, this situation with Dylan Harper and De'Aaron Fox is there's not 50 games of sample size left for him to be like, in the long run, I think De'Aaron Fox is the right guy. I think Dylan Harper deserves to get the bulk of the minutes at point guard for the San Antonio Spurs if this is the version of De'Aaron Fox that we're going to get. Now, like you said, he might come back healthier, feeling better, getting a little bit more, quicker first step and feeling stronger with his ankle. But also we're running up against time. They now have to win four games before the Knicks win three. And so we'll see. But the De'Aaron Fox factor looms very large in this series. And I think we would not be doing the same. We would be telling Jalen Brunson, you need to be better if you're averaging 10 points a game in his last five games.
Right.
Like that, we would absolutely hold him to that standard. And the same goes for De'Aaron Fox, who was acquired to be this veteran presence who was in the postseason. And we talk about Sohan and how he's kind of the mole for the New York Knicks. Well, De'Aaron Fox also knows Mike Brown as the head coach of the Sacramento Kings. And so this is a really big moment for De'Aaron Fox in game two, a guy who is making $37 million this season, which is way more than any other player. And then it jumps to $50 million as his extension kicks in next year. They absolutely need him to play up to his billing.
Yeah, to whom much is given, much is expected, right? And, you know, what they're not getting sort of commensurate value at this point. And, you know, if this is like, I think you expect, it's reasonable to expect that Brunson's going to win that head-to-head matchup, right? Although that's obviously not really head-to-head. They're both guarding different guys, whatever. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Positional matchup. It can't be a blowout, though. Can't be like a wipe out, a washout. And that's what it felt like in game one. And if it feels like that as the series goes on, I think the balance of power shifts even further toward New York in a series where they've already kind of chopped one leg out from the Spurs, taken home court advantage, and now they're going to start trying to lean on them. I think the beginning, the start of game two is going to be fascinating because you'd expect the Spurs are going to come out like a house of fire. The Knicks have, when they're presented with an opportunity to go for a team's throat in this playoffs, the Knicks have not missed it yet. I'm going to be fascinated to see what the beginning of game two looks like.
I was there in 2012 when the Miami Heat lost game one and then just swept the young Oklahoma City Thunder. Maybe that happens in this series, but man, they're going to need a lot more from De'Aaron Fox if they want to turn this thing around against a Knicks team that is just blowing teams out. I can't believe they won that game by double digits game one in San Antonio.
It was free throws, margin of victory at the end. But yeah, like this was a one possession game with like a minute and a half left and they win by 10. And I think that's now seven straight road wins by double digits for the Knicks, which is just, it's bonkers. It's bonkers stuff. Now, granted, these games are starting to feel less and less like road games, but still pretty impressive stuff to go into somebody else's gym and continually hang these kind of crooked numbers there.
Well, we got to go through the rest of the league here. I mentioned Eric Spoelstra, the Miami Heat, quite a bit there in that segment. We're going to talk about them and the Giannis sweepstakes that seems to be heating up. We got some reporting from Sam Amick and Eric Name over at The Athletic, and some really, really interesting stuff as we wind towards the draft and free agency here. A lot of buzz around the NBA while we're watching this NBA Finals and what happens if the New York Knicks lose or if the San Antonio Spurs lose. And OKC, we haven't talked since that loss, Dan. So let's get into the Giannis stuff here coming up after the break. I was talking with an executive yesterday who, Dan, said everybody's having that conversation, the Chet Holmgren conversation, and the dominoes that would fall if OKC decides to make a major move here after they lost to the San Antonio Spurs in the Western Conference Finals. But then there's an even bigger domino, maybe not in like height, but I think in terms of like substance is Giannis Antetokounmpo. And whether he has a new, did you see the new ad with the whole grease pun? I don't know if you caught that from Kalshi.
So trying my best not to click on Kalshi stuff, but I saw the screen, like the teaser, the thumbnail of him in a leather jacket with like a pompadour. And I kind of did the math quick and I was like, oh, I get the joke. I don't think I need to watch this. It's nice to see, I guess, nice to see grease jokes in the big year 2026. Not sure who that's for, but sure, fair enough. Anyways, I'm sorry. Big guy,
a lot of teams,
very strong, a lot of teams.
A lot of teams are going to be looking at him saying, you're the one that I want. Ooh, ooh, ooh. How about that? How about that?
Dude, can I, sorry, this has nothing to do with anything. One of the first things that when we started dating that my wife told me was like, I hate the Grease Megamix, like that you would hear at the end of a school dance where they would play like four of those songs together. She was like, if that's one song I never want to hear. I was like, were you worried I was going to like put it on the jukebox at the bar? Like, what are you talking about? She's like, I don't know, but it feels important to me that you know that. And now it's important to me that the big number listenership and viewership knows it. Anyways, one that I want, Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Yeah. That was a great little anecdote. So thank you. Especially if we get more of those, I'm rooting for you not to get any sleep the rest of the way. So just letting you know, I'm sorry in advance, that if we get more of those little trinkets, I would love to make that environment happen. So here's what we have from Sam Amick and Eric Name over at The Athletic. They list four teams among the eliminated, playoff teams. So they kind of put aside the Knicks and the Spurs. Knicks, obviously, we've heard about it, you know, over the last year, is that Giannis Antetokounmpo wanted to go to the Knicks. The truth of that whole thing and the degrees and the, it's not black or white, or the gray area in that trade demand to the Knicks, what have you, that ESPN and others have been reporting on, we won't know. But safe to say that the Knicks are pretty good without Giannis Antetokounmpo now that they're up 1-0 against the San Antonio Spurs, three wins away from the NBA championship, the elusive championship, without home court advantage going into this series, and they're pretty close. So they might not need that guy, the Greek Freak. But the teams that might look at him as a target, the loudest noise that we're hearing, you know, Eric Spoelstra always likes to talk about the noise outside that locker room.
Sure.
Well, Sam Amick talking in this story, the noise surrounding the Miami Heat and Antetokounmpo remains louder than all the rest. Many people around the league, from agents to executives, continue to believe that Antetokounmpo will end up in Miami when this saga finally comes to an end. So they list the Miami Heat, the Celtics, the Magic, and the Cavs as potential destinations for the big man from Milwaukee. Look, I think it's pretty obvious that the Miami Heat are going big game hunting, trying to bring in another star. Now that Jimmy Butler is with the Golden State Warriors, recovering from an ACL tear, I could see that the Miami Heat are going to try to do everything they can to move mountains to get Giannis Antetokounmpo to come to Miami. I don't know if they have the best potential package to get Giannis, but if you look at Tyler Hero, Khalil Ware, Jaime Jaquez, some picks. They have their own first round pick in this year's draft. That does seem like to me something that on the table, the Milwaukee Bucks have to at least consider, the 13th pick in this year's draft and some young talents. But are they blue chip young talents, Dan? I don't know. Like Tyler Hero on the contract that he demands is not some young guy on his rookie scale contract that they can compete and still have another star and fit it into their cap structure. With Tyler Hero, he's getting paid like a star, and I'm not so sure he's in the black when it comes to surplus value on that contract going forward. You can argue that Khalil Ware has the upside that you would want in a rebuilding team, but in a new draft lottery system, I don't think that the Bucks are going to be aiming to bottom out. So in terms of Pat Riley trying to bring home one last superstar to Miami, I think it makes a lot of sense that the Heat are going to put all their chips in the middle to go get this guy. Question is whether the Milwaukee Bucks look at this offer from the potential offer from the Miami Heat as the best one on the table. The other teams, Boston, Orlando, and Cleveland, I think could put better offers in there. But I can't, after they got Jimmy Butler, after they got LeBron and Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade for that triumvirate, I can't rule out that Pat Riley and the Miami Heat are going to have another trick up their sleeve. What do you make of that? Is that the Miami Heat around the league seem to be the favorites to land Giannis?
It makes sense for the reasons that you mentioned. You know, the Heat clearly have been in on every star or near star that has, you know, theoretically come on the market. You know, they're obviously heavily involved in the Damian Lillard discussion before he went to Milwaukee. You know, multiple pursuits of Kevin Durant, you know, reporting that they would be interested in Donovan Mitchell if he ever sort of shook loose in Cleveland, on and on and on. And it makes sense, you know, like the Heat have just kind of, they've been since the end of the Jimmy era, when Jimmy made it clear that the era was ending, I suppose is a better way to put that. They've kind of just been meandering in the middle. You know, they don't have really a direction or a gravitational star. Giannis certainly would be that. Your point about the Tyler Hero contract situation is interesting. I mean, it's not just that he might be underwater on his current deal. It's, I believe he enters free agency in 2027. Yeah. So you'd be on the hook for the next one. And what do you want to pay Tyler Hero moving forward on that deal? And like, if he's a negative value now or potentially a negative value now, at a higher dollar figure moving forward, probably would only be less so. And then, you know, what is that commensurate value for what you're looking for? I mean, the reporting from Sam and Eric is that the Bucks are on the lookout for a deal that includes a blue chip young star or a massive quantity of picks. And so as you go through these, you know, the other reporting, I believe our guys Mark Stein and Jake Fisher have over at the Steinline newsletter have talked about the rumblings that Giannis would prefer to stay in the East, which is why, you know, discussions about maybe Portland,
yep,
maybe not so excited about that, or, you know, OKC, I guess, you know, it's technically like Southeast, but it is West, you know, like that. Those are, you know, if that were to come online, well, you know, would he be interested in that? So then you look at these options and it's like, well, if the Cavs continue to signal, and Kobe Altman was saying very loudly that Evan Mobley is not on the, you know, he's not going anywhere. He's not on the table. Although I guess, you know, in Cleveland, Myles Garrett just got traded. So who the hell knows? Maybe things can change pretty quickly. Yeah. You know, to say that, you know, they bring up Orlando as a potential option because Sean Sweeney, who just got hired as the head coach there, was with Giannis in Milwaukee, was his like development guy, was part of that coaching staff with Jay Kidd when Giannis kind of came online there. And Paolo, obviously we've talked a lot about the question of how valuable Paolo is, and, you know, is he going to be somebody that you build around going forward? I would wonder if you are kind of just trading, like you're improving the quality of the player in that spot, but you kind of have the same problem bringing in Giannis for Paolo, where you're like, I've got a four who needs the ball and needs to be getting downhill next to Franz Wagner, who also is a four who needs the ball and to be getting downhill, and nobody's shooting, and we don't have a spacing five really that helps us out. So like, it's a higher class version of the same problem, but, you know, maybe higher class version of the same problem is fine. The interesting one, and we haven't hit it yet, is Boston, right? Where there's Stein had recently reported that the Boston is Miami and Boston are increasingly perceived to be the potential destinations that currently, underline currently, most intrigue Giannis. So I can understand that, right? The Celtics won a championship a couple of years ago. They are a perennial conference finals or higher contender. They went through what was supposed to be a gap year and won 56 games and, you know, like had a phenomenal season. They got Jason Tatum back healthy. Like, I get it. Plus, add in all the questions about Jaylen Brown and streaming and whatnot. you know, I could see it. But yeah, the point, it's got to make sense on both sides, right? Like, if you're the Bucks, you're signing up for a gigantic deal for Jaylen Brown, who's not that much younger than Giannis. And yeah, doesn't have the same injury history, has been more durable, all that kind of stuff. Are you then trying to redirect him? And then what's the market for him? You know, I find myself coming back to, we are looking for blue chip young talent and a massive amount of picks. And I don't know that any of this gets the Bucks there. And unless you're going to start entertaining the idea of like, well, who else has the massive caches of picks? Like Brooklyn, you're not getting blue chip young talent there, but you can get every pick you want. Or, you know, I mean, who else? You know, I guess Houston has a decent chunk of picks. Atlanta has a decent chunk of picks. I don't know that that one team is going to satisfy all of these goals, which then leads me to, are we talking a three-team deal? Are we talking a four-team deal? And then I haven't slept enough to be able to do all that. So I'm not really sure exactly where that leaves us. But yeah, I mean, does that make sense to you, Tom? I'm looking at it and I'm saying, I don't know that any of these formulations serve all masters in the way that the Bucks seem to want to get it done. But then maybe if Giannis decides, I want to get out of here, and the Bucks just decide we want to be done with this, maybe getting serving whatever master you can in that moment is good enough. I don't know.
Yeah, I think Orlando makes the most sense as a destination from the pure like young blue chip player, 23 years old, Paolo Banchero, that you can sell your fan base that we got a former number one overall pick, all-star Team USA guy, where you can build a franchise around Paolo Banchero. Didn't work out in Orlando, but we're going to put some pieces around him that make more sense. But clearly, Jamal Mosley in Orlando and Paolo Banchero, all the smoke suggested that they didn't see eye to eye at all. And so maybe Orlando wants to give Sean Sweeney a shot with Paolo Banchero as the focal point of this franchise before they make any decisions on Giannis Antetokounmpo. But how often are you going to have the opportunity to get Giannis? And so I think I would place this as the Miami Heat have a real shot at Giannis, but I do not discount Orlando as a destination because of the Sean Sweeney factor. But also there is, I think, a little of, we want to make a big splash here. We're changing our head coaches, and the fit between Franz Wagner and Desmond Bane and Paolo Banchero, they almost took down Detroit in the first round. But I do think that there's some potential of that, because if they want a young player, Jaylen Brown does not qualify. Tyler Hero coming home to Milwaukee sounds great in theory, but then you look at the contract and the investment bias of, I guess we'll have to extend him to validate this trade for him. That does seem like a hazard for the Milwaukee Bucks to consider whether that really is the smart move. But maybe the gem of that trade in their eyes would be Khalil Ware or something like that. That's why Giannis hasn't been traded, is because I don't know if all these packages, they're either on the table or enticing enough for them to push the button. So we'll see what happens with that. I think as we round into the draft, I think it's pretty clear to me at least that Giannis has played his last days in Milwaukee, and the Grease commercial and some other, you know, sit down that he had recently that seemed to suggest that he wants to play in Milwaukee for a very long time. I don't buy all that when all the reporting behind the scenes suggests. I mean, look at
oh my
this.
God.
I don't know.
Sorry. If you're not watching on YouTube, you should be, because you can see why I just like had a real like immediate revulsion to the screen cap of Giannis in this Grease commercial. What are we doing, I guess, is my main question. But I'm sorry, Tom. That was unprofessional of me to allow my shock at that image to derail what you were saying. I apologize.
Just watch. You can hate watch the commercial if you'd like. If you just need a little
maybe,
pick-me,
I don't know,
Dan, and a little laugh.
I don't know
if you do that. It's it's a weird world that I think Kalshi still has like a prediction line on whether Giannis gets moved or not. I haven't checked that. Honestly, I don't know. But all of it is a strange world that we're living in. One that is the New York Knicks 3 wins away from winning the championship. So Dan, go get some rest. I know this is the finals. We're grinding here in the finals, but man, awesome job by you. Great column. Go check it out on Yahoo Sports NBA, where we'll be doing this again next week on The Big Number. Go subscribe to Yahoo NBA, where you can find not just this, but the Dunker Spot, as well as the Kevin O'Connor Show. We'll be back again next week here on The Big Number. Dan, thank you so much. And everyone be safe as we head into the weekend.
Go watch Grease 2. It's more fun.